Good afternoon. I am Lynn Rhodes, editor of the New England Quarterly, and I would like to welcome you to another episode in the NEQ MIT ongoing series of podcasts. Today, we will be hearing from Paul Friedman, author of American Restaurants and Cuisine in the Mid-19th Century. Despite our society's current fascination with Zagat ratings and celebrity chefs, the origins of American fine dining have remained largely unexplored by historians. And so I invite you to listen in as Professor Friedman of Yale University and Rebecca Fetterman of the New York Public Library discuss the food American restaurants had on offer in the Civil War era. You will also want to access Paul's essay, the appendix of which names approximately 1,000 separate dishes served at one Northeastern hotel between 1859 and 1865, a list where you will find both the familiar and the obscure, heirlooms, and dinosaurs.
My name is Rebecca Fetterman. I'm the Culinary Collections Librarian at the New York Public Library, and I'm here speaking with Paul Friedman, Professor of History at Yale University, on his article in the March 2011 issue of the New England Quarterly called American Restaurants and Cuisine in the Mid-19th Century. And Paul, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your research findings. In going over the menus in the library's collection, you found number of dishes that are referenced quite frequently, and the most referenced dish throughout your menu research is macaroni. It's on 88% of all the Fifth Avenue Hotel menus, for example. When someone mentions macaroni today, one thinks generally of elbow macaroni. Is this the shape that 19th century diners would have eaten? What is meant by macaroni, or do we even know?
It is elbow macaroni. It's a little surprising that macaroni should turn out to be the single most frequent item on these menus. These are very high-end restaurants, so this is not intended to be inexpensive or comfort food, but it surpasses even such popular dishes as various kinds of oysters or mutton or beef. And it comes in about 8 or 9 ways, and it does seem to be our familiar elbow macaroni served in various proportions and in various ways with cream, with cheese, and baked or cooked on a stove.
Were there any other sauces, did you see, in your findings?
They have a lot of different ways of combining these things. So sometimes it's boiled slowly with milk, cream, and then cheese is added. Sometimes it's cooked on the stove and then baked a little bit closer to what we would be familiar with. Sometimes with meat, sometimes made as a sweet dish with puddings, although that appears as a pudding, it appears more in cookbooks than in hotel menus.
What other kinds of dishes did you come across the most frequently besides macaroni?
Well, there are a lot of oyster dishes, either served on the half shell. All of these oyster dishes are cooked, so baked on their shells, or cut up and made into patties, oyster patties, a la bechamel, very popular. Other very popular dishes include mutton, sometimes served as cutlets, sometimes chopped up and sort of made into like a hash called a haricot, French term basically, haricot of mutton a la bourgeoise, for example, is mentioned in 140, 150 menus from the Fifth Avenue Hotel. Apple fritters are very popular. Baked beans and pork. These are, you know, not incredibly elegant sounding dishes, but they are American dishes par excellence of the 19th century. Very popular on these menus.
They're very sort of comfort food dishes, and they remind me of the kinds of foods that one would see perhaps on an elegant French restaurant menu today, but sort of the roast chicken equivalent, you know, where you go to a restaurant and there's all these unique items and then you see a roast chicken or a salmon or sort of more familiar foods. Many of the dishes, are these dishes that would have been prepared at home? I mean, these comfort foods clearly would have been prepared at home if you saw them in cookbooks of the time. Did you see many other dishes in cookbooks, or was this really was dining out really about trying new things?
Well, as with now, as you point out, it's both. That is, people sometimes want what we consider to be comfort food or things that they could make at home, but either the restaurant perhaps makes it better, roast chicken, or that just happens to be what they want, whether they can get that at home or not. There are almost 1,000 different entrees at the Fifth Avenue Hotel menus, which go on over a series of years, and each menu, each day is different. So if you look at these entrees, they include very fancy dishes, either fancy in the sense that they involve difficult to obtain or expensive game birds, such as reed birds, prairie hens, canvasback ducks, and things like that, or venison, or expensive because they involve turtles, terrapins, green turtles, and other exotic sea creatures. Also, what the restaurants would serve that people would not make at home, or that certainly don't appear in cookbooks of the era, are things with the fancier kinds of French sauces. So a sauce financière with meat distillate and truffles, or sauce Robert, which is another kind of reduction sauce, meat sauce with mustard and white wine. A lot of things, sauce Robert, or sauce financière, or à la soubise, à la poulette, these various kinds of French preparations. These would be more uniquely restaurant items. But the basic meat served with this would be things like pork cutlets, lamb cutlets, tenderloin of beef. Expensive, but not overwhelmingly exotic either.
So you spent some time looking at the Fifth Avenue hotels, as you mentioned, and menus from the Revere House in Boston and also the American Hotel. Did you see a lot of differences in the kinds of dishes that were served at? There was obviously a bit of overlap, but were there dishes that really stood out that were different?
In general, the menus are very similar.
Okay.
And I found that, indeed, I looked at about 85 different restaurants across the United States between about 1835 and 1865. And the menus are pretty similar, more similar than you would expect given the different regions of the United States and the fact that technology and transport had not yet made it easy to send items across the country. There are some regional characteristics, but, so that you're going to have certain kinds of fish in the Northeast, like shad. Shad is more popular in New York restaurants than in Boston restaurants. On the other hand, cod seems to be more popular in Boston. But the menus are very varied and have a lot of different kinds of entrees. But the difference between, say, the Revere House and the Fifth Avenue Hotel is minimal.
And what about other parts of the country? So you looked at a few places in the South and in the Midwest as well.
You get more game in the Midwest at this at this time, and sometimes they will even celebrate it. A restaurant in Fort Atkinson, Kansas, had a kind of pioneer celebration in the 1870s where they had all these local game dishes, and they gave them mock French names. So, Wolverine a la bourgeoise, or prairie chickens a la crapaudine. So they make it appear as if these are very elegant. But, of course, this is not meant to fool anybody. It's a kind of self-satirizing thing. So game, bear. In the West, different kinds of fish, Dungeness crabs, sand dabs, Rexall. Similarly, in New Orleans, things prepared a la Creole. On the other hand, you see things a la Creole in New York and in Boston as well. What they mean in New York and Boston is probably with tomatoes, celery, and onions, or some sort of sauce involving those basic ingredients. And probably a la Creole in New Orleans would be more authentic and a little more complicated. But there are certain national kinds of tastes, even a few foreign dishes, or at least pseudo-foreign dishes. So the curry is very popular in New York and in Boston. The most popular kind of curry, however, is lobster curry.
So you mentioned a number of these different kinds of fish and game, and how you say sort of these menus demonstrate the essential poverty of the 21st century natural as well as culinary environment. So many of the ingredients you came upon in these menus is no longer available, or at least easily available to diners. Which dishes of the ones you referenced do you think, if the ingredients were made available, could make a comeback?
Well, there are a lot of duck dishes, and there are all kinds of ducks, black ducks, brant ducks, redheads, a kind of duck called a reed bird. Some of these are still reasonably common. So the most prized dish of the 19th century is very difficult to find, canvasback ducks. But duck hunters routinely shoot mallards and some of these other kinds of ducks. So you could bring a greater variety of ducks back, wild ducks back. And in fact, this is starting to come back a little. In general, if I had to say what I am surprised has not become fashionable, this is not to say that it's going to be, mm-hmm. but game. I would say that's the next frontier. You know, now that the innards and entrails of animals have a certain fashion at mm-hmm. Mario Batali's Babbo and Al Posto to start out with, but now spreading in all these head-to-tail kinds of establishments, I would have thought that game would make a comeback. So you heard that here first. So all ducks right. could make a comeback. Terrapins, turtles, I don't see that becoming widely available for environmental reasons. And some birds also are not likely to be very fashionable. There's some dishes for robins, not uncommon, but not something that sounds very appealing to us. Robins encrustade, for example, or robins in cases, as in sort of a pastry. But quails, there are all sorts of different kinds of quail dishes, a la jardiniere, encrustade with champagne sauce, larded with mushrooms. Those could certainly come back, and even if they're not wild, they're pretty tasty.
Most of the menus that you looked at were really from the 1830s to the end of the Civil War, but you did look at a few into the 1870s, 1880s?
Yes, the New York Public Library has this incredible collection of Fifth Avenue hotel menus, 365 per volume, 22 volumes between 1859 when it opened and well into the 1880s. And I have not analyzed every one of these volumes, but comparing one of the 1880s volumes, 81, 82, with the earlier ones, I'm struck by how little has changed.
Oh, really?
And this is a surprise because, generally speaking, histories of food in the United States emphasize the ostentation, the fanciness, and the Frenchness of the Gilded Age, the period of wealth after the Civil War, so beginning in the 1870s and lasting through the 1880s, you would expect that dishes would be more French, more truffles, more extravagant. I would say actually that you get that same combination of extravagant French terminology, lots of truffles indeed, but an awful lot of baked beans and pork, mm-hmm. and an awful lot of macaroni still in 1883, just as in 1859.
And which other, you mentioned the New York Public Library's collection, did you consult other research institutions for their menus as well?
Yes. The New York Public Library, in terms of quantity and particularly these runs of volumes, is unique. And that has been my main source. And as you who have helped me with this so generously know, it's really an incredible resource. But beyond the New York Public Library, there's a wonderful collection at the American Antiquarian Society in Worcester, and that material is mostly available on its database called American Broadsides and Ephemera. The collector, Henry Voigt, mm-hmm. in Wilmington, Delaware, has assembled a marvelous collection of menus from the United States, and his 19th century menus are both very extensive and in beautiful, really perfect condition. He's been very generous in sharing that with us. State historical societies are often very rich. The Minnesota State Historical Society, for example, has a lot of stuff. New York City Historical Society here has a lot of early menus. California Historical Society, Bancroft Library, the Culinary history collection at Johnson & Wales University in Providence, Rhode Island. So there's an awful lot of stuff. There's some famous collections that I didn't use extensively because they start a little later than 1865. So Cornell has a wonderful collection, but it's mostly later. Culinary Institute of America, same thing.
So this brings me to sort of the research process. Now, you're a medieval historian. And so what really led you to doing the dining habits of 19th century America?
I guess a kind of hobby got out of hand. I was always interested in food and food history, but I didn't start actually writing about it or thinking about it systematically until about 8-9 years ago, when I had a fellowship at the New York Public Library, and I had that fellowship to write a book about spices in the Middle Ages. That project, a book called Out of the East, The Desire for Spices in the Middle Ages, was really the bridge between my interests in medieval social history and then the interest in the history of food generally, because, of course, spices are a well-known passion of the Middle Ages, of upper-class taste in the Middle Ages, and of medieval dining. And I was interested in why, and what about spices was so attractive. But at the same time, when I was at the public library, was the time of the menu exhibit. This would be the spring of 2003, the exhibit that was curated by William Grimes. And I was just so fascinated by these menus that I think that's really what inspired me most of all. Some of the methods of research are similar to what one does in medieval history. You know, you sort of look for sources in odd places. You look for non-obvious things. And you certainly have a toleration for tedium and a liking of the result and endurance of the process.
Going back to what you found in your research, most of these menus are, I assume, dinner menus, meaning the main meal of the day, which would have been about, what, 3 to 6 p.m., a little earlier than that?
A little earlier. It varies. At the Fifth Avenue Hotel, dinner would be from 2 to 4, generally.
And so these were all dinner menus, or were any of them lunch menus or breakfast menus that you came across?
All of the menus that they save are dinner menus. There are other menus from there and from other places for other meals, some of which overlap dinner. So, for example, they have dinner available from 2 to 4, but they'll also have what's called a table d'hôte meal served at one particular time. So a table d'hôte at 4 o'clock, so that if you wanted, the selection there might be a little less extensive, but you would be assured of a meal at that particular time. That's the more older style, sort of pre-restaurant restaurant. One of the things that distinguishes restaurants is that you can get a meal over a period of time rather than having to show up at exactly a certain hour. There are teas, suppers, lunches, all of which may cut into, overlap, or in some sense substitute for dinner. But the well-off adults would take dinner usually between 2 and 4 at these establishments. Servants and children were served at specified times, usually earlier.
But the offerings would largely be the same.
Oh, servants and children would get less choice.
Right. Speaking of choice, you know, you talk about 2 soups, 2 fish, a half a dozen or so boiled dishes, et cetera, et cetera. Were people supposed to eat as much food as is listed on these menus? How was it served? Was it given sort of a buffet style? Were they given a, you know, could they choose what sort of roast they wanted to eat?
You know, this is not all that easy to determine in detail for any single establishment. But the general principles, I guess, are these. The first is, They did eat more than we do. They certainly were willing to put away gigantic breakfasts and then sit down to this multi-course, 8-course meal. And, you know, why is that? Were they fatter? Did they exercise more? They certainly weren't that much bigger or bigger at all. I'm not sure I have a good physiological answer for that. Mm-hmm. They certainly ate more and ate with a lot of gusto and don't seem to have had an awful lot of guilt about that. Partly, of course, body image was different and plumpness was fine, even though these menus make it look as if you'd be more than merely plump if you consumed everything. The next thing is that, no, they don't consume everything. You know, the Fifth Avenue Hotel has from 8 to 12 entrees. You had your choice of these. And it's not a buffet. It's served by waiters. There's a big ratio of staff to customers. And the waiters moved kind of in military precision and would serve dishes, cut them up. You could request specific entrees, but a little bit like a cruise ship or a wedding party, you could, if you wanted, have almost everything. Wow. You know how now we have buffets and stations, you know, so if you want sushi and pasta and omelets and pancakes and whatever at some of these hotel brunches or resort extravaganzas, you can have that if for some reason that suits your mood. Similarly with these meals. So they would be served in courses. You had only maybe 8 to 10 minutes per course.
Wow.
Waiters moved you through. And indeed, foreigners particularly comment on the extravagant amounts of food served in the United States, which is the same as now, and the incredible rapidity with which these meals were consumed. Not a lot of conversation.
And these were largely at hotels. I think almost all of the menus you consulted were from hotels.
There are some famous freestanding restaurants at this right. time. Delmonico's, probably the most famous restaurant in the United States in New York, or Antoine's in New Orleans. But the establishments for fine dining tended to be hotels. That's right.
And this would have been under the American plan.
Yes, the so-called American plan was where you got your meal and your hotel room for a set price. So these menus don't have prices. Not only do they not have prices for individual dishes because you sort of got everything you wanted, but they don't have an overall price for the menu as a whole. We know from the accounts of travelers that the prices ranged from $1 to $3, mm-hmm. which is a not insubstantial amount in, say, 1860, but is not out of reach of all but a very tiny minority. In other words, sort of the same kinds of people who go to reasonably nice restaurants now, a minority, but a very significant number, would be similar in that era.
And you mentioned children and servants eating a little earlier. And you also talk about this a dinner at the St. Nicholas Hotel in 1853 where men and women dined together, which was apparently fairly unusual. Did you notice a difference in the food offerings of ladies' menus versus gentlemen's menus?
Yeah, the standard was to have a ladies' restaurant and a men's restaurant. And generally, if a man and woman were a married couple or accompanying each other, the dinner would be taken in the ladies' restaurant, men's restaurant being thought to be too rough, too coarse for women to be in. The mingling of the sexes, however, was never really unusual, and it became more common as the century wore on. The Fifth Avenue Hotel seems to have had men and women dining together right from the start, that is from 1859. But where you have a ladies' restaurant, so-called ladies' ordinary, there's nothing that you can discern that distinguishes it from the men's. They have the same kidneys sautéed with port wine sauce, the same calves head and brain sauce, the same roasts, the same lamb cutlets, the same pig's feet, all sorts of things that we would not think of as feminine food. It is the case, however, that as early as the 1850s, there are establishments, particularly ice cream parlors, that were thought to be for women or were set up for women as places to go as relaxation from shopping, for example, so that the association of women with ice cream is perhaps the first, chicken salad with sauce on the side mm-hmm. kind of ladies' dining.
And we mentioned before that most of these are hotel menus. Did you, in your research, come across sort of tavern menus or more freestanding but less high-end restaurants from the same time period, or are those hard to find?
Those are a little harder to find. They're sort of not the sort of things that people save as souvenirs.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, we have them. Sometimes they have separate prices. They are not radically different. They'll have some of the same kinds of dishes, at least of the more modest type. They'll have baked beans and pork. They'll have a turkey hash with eggs. and things like that. They'll even have terrapin, a sort of special order. And in one case from the 1860s, the terrapin costs a dollar, which is three times what almost any other item on the menu cost. Chicken is also relatively expensive at that time.
And did you keep track of the wines that were served? I mean, what kinds of beverages would be served? I mean, Madeira accompanying some of the dishes. But did you, in your research, did you mark down also what was being served?
The wines are usually listed on a separate page, and they do have separate prices. And then as now, you could spend way more on wine than on the dinner. So the most expensive wines, particularly in the 1840s, 1850s, are Madeira.
Mm-hmm.
Madeira is a wine that was very popular in the United States, in part because it improves with transport. Unlike most wines or even most edible products, it likes being shaken around. And indeed, prized Madeiras were those that had been, say, around Cape Horn or some really rough, stormy area. So the wine in the casks was sort of shaken. Madeira also is very, very durable. You could drink Madeira that was 100 years old. Then as now. Americans eventually lost the taste for Madeira by the end of the 19th century. The other very expensive kind of wines are German white wines, Hock, as they were then called, Rhine wines, Schloss Johannisberger, which is still one of the great white wines of the Rhine. These wines would go for maybe $4.
Mm.
The most expensive Madeira, I think, that I've seen, $12 or $13. In other words, from 5 to 10 times the price of the meal. But again, if you wanted a 1961 Petrus or a 1982 Romane Conti, you would be paying in the tens of thousands of dollars for that. And no meal, at least to my knowledge, in the United States in terms of just food,
right,
is going to come anywhere near that.
So do you plan to continue your research in this project? Go further into the Gilded Age and continue doing?
I'd like to do more with the remaining Fifth Avenue Hotel menus at the New York Public Library. There are so many of them. And if I could analyze the data from all 22 of them, I think I'd have something interesting to say about American dining habits. I'd like also to continue looking at different parts of the country. I made a start at that, but the decentralization of historical collections and archives is such that I think there's some interesting things to find. I'd like particularly to learn more about New Orleans in the 19th century, because then as now, it's a really distinctive and wonderful cuisine. There aren't a whole lot of menus that survive, but I think one could use other sources such as travelers' descriptions. Ideally, I'd like to get a sense of dining in, say, Boston, New York, San Francisco, New Orleans, Chicago, the major gastronomic centers throughout the 19th century, and see how much they differed and how much their tastes were similar.
Great. Well, thank you so much for talking
Thanks
today.
Thanks for this opportunity. I enjoyed it.
And I look forward to seeing you in the Rare Books Division again to look at more menus.
I'll be there.
All right. Thanks, Paul.
This has been an MIT Press Journals podcast. For more information on the New England Quarterly or any of our publications, please visit our website at www.mitpressjournals.org.